We're here today to discuss the incident that occurred with a Compton resident last week. This is not an us versus them discussion. We are here today about equity and justice. We are here today to discuss the treatment of Compton residents, black and brown people, especially our young men, by the sheriff's deputies. And let me say that again, it's some sheriff's deputies. It's important for me to distinguish some, because not all officers use excessive force, harass, or violate the civil liberties of our residents, yet some do. And we are here to demand consequences for any member of law enforcement that violates the rights of human beings. Black men are people too. Brown men are people too. Black and brown women are people too. And our lives are at risk. According to the Times' most recent report, since 2000, there have been nearly 900 killings by police that were ruled a homicide by county medical examiners. Almost all of the dead were men. Nearly 80% were black and Latino. More than 98% of those killed were shot. According to the Times, in all but two cases, the use of force was deemed legally justifiable by the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office, which is responsible for conducting an investigation into each incident to render justice for the people. Since 2000, only two officers have been charged as a result of a shooting of a civilian while on duty. Count them with me. One, two. We are at a place in time where staying the same is no longer an option. The whole world has changed. Our families have changed. Businesses have changed. Churches have changed. Schools have changed. Cities have changed. And law enforcement must change. Today, we are here to discuss the incident that occurred with Dalvin Price, a Compton resident, that was on his way home Sunday, May 31st. The Sheriff's Department chose to release a statement that painted the picture that this man is guilty. I don't know where Dalvin was going or coming from. The fact is, it doesn't even matter. He has not been charged with a crime. He has not become before a judge, nor has he been sentenced for a crime. No officer has the right to render justice sight on hand. And excessive force, or even worse, death, because they believe someone is guilty or they deserve it. Isn't this America? Don't black and brown people have the right to due process? This is someone's loved one, a human being. What if this was your child? Compton residents deserve, and we are here to demand equitable treatment, period. We are tired of dodging sheriff's cars that have no regard for traffic laws or personal property, being snatched out of our cars, having our vehicles illegally searched, being threatened and intimidated, beaten and in some cases murdered, like Ryan Twyman and countless others. We demand the same treatment that deputies provide to the residents of Malibu, Palos Verdes, and other communities. And according to the size of our sheriff's contract, they have 22 million reasons to do so, and we have 22 million reasons to expect it. Dalvin and his family will tell their own story, and the courageous resident, Sister Asia Hall, who filmed the incident, and subsequently she and her family have been harassed by Compton Sheriff's deputies, she will tell her own story as well.
David D. Hard Knock Radio hanging out with you this afternoon. We wanted to start off our show by playing a clip of the mayor of Compton talking about her encounters with the Compton Sheriff Department, talking about a gang that exists within that department called the Executioners. It was very disturbing to hear that press conference. It's not often that you have a city official come out and talk very openly about the troublesome nature of a police department, at least on the level that this mayor did. And I want to contrast the reaction to it. There was a little bit of buzz. There were stories that were written about this gang within the Compton Police Department, and then the UK Guardian and Al Jazeera, and some of the bigger papers carried it, but it wasn't a lot of fanfare about it. Compare that press conference with the press conference about protesters and folks labeling a group like Antifa as a threat to this country. And not only do we have endless stories about that group, but we've actually seen policies go into place to try and quote-unquote stop them. And that's not even a gang, per se. We've seen similar type of reactions when they pointed out the flaws of, say, folks in Chicago. There will be a press conference by the mayor over there. Next thing you know, we see policy changes and a commitment to eradicate what they call a problem. I wanted to talk to Alex Alonzo. He's been on the scene since the mid-90s, covering gang activity in Southern California and beyond. He owns the streetgangs.com. He is also a professor over at Cal State University at Long Beach. And he's the foremost expert, one of the foremost experts around the country when we talk about gangs and why they operate and how they operate, et cetera, et cetera. So there was no better person to really talk to about the gangs that exist within the police department. So welcome to the show, Alex, and how you doing?
Thanks a lot. I'm doing good. Thanks for having me, David E.
When you say gangs, we think of Bloods, Crips, Vice Lords, street gangs, and we often associate them with, you know, young black people and say this is a problem that needs to be eradicated. But there's been gangs within the police departments in Southern California in particular that we've known of for a very long time, but it seems to have gone underneath the radar. From your standpoint, can you give us a brief rundown of what we're looking at in terms of their history and their presence in these departments?
Yeah, most definitely. We've had police gangs in Southern California, specifically Los Angeles County, going back to about 1970. So we're talking about 50 years of this type of police gang activity going on. And one of the reasons why it's been under the radar is because in the very early years of these street gang police organizations, just a lot of people just didn't believe it. And it just sounded so mythological and unrealistic to bring it up. And even when I started mentioning these police gangs around 94, 95, 96, a lot of people were not convinced. And I've actually mentioned some of these gangs operating within the police department in the very early 2000s, testifying in court cases. And oftentimes judges don't even want to allow or introduce that into evidence. I know several cases going back into the 90s where judges would not allow that to come in as evidence on a police officer that was coming to testify against a young black or brown body. So that's one of the reasons why they've been they've stayed under the radar, because the judges and the system has done a great job at kind of sweeping it under the rug.
Let me ask you this. I've testified in court as well as expert witness, and so I'm familiar with that process, and I wanted to know what happens when you say, in the context of your testifying, your expert testimony, you mentioned that, hey, there is a gang like the Vikings or something. Do they tell the jury to strike that? Do they say that what you're saying is not, cannot be introduced as evidence because, quote unquote, you're not an expert? How do they justify removing it from the record?
Yeah, man, this is a great question. And this is actually a conversation we need to have with the way that the courts need to be reformed. We've been talking about police that need to be reformed, but really, I've been saying this ever since George Floyd, they're killing us in the courtroom. And what happens when a police officer has this gang reputation, everyone already knows this before the jury is even picked. Okay, so the prosecutor and the defense attorneys already have established that this officer is a rogue officer. So what they've done, before I even get to come testify, it has already been determined. The conversation has already taken place through different pre-trial hearings that this is not going to come up as evidence. Now, what an expert can do, such as myself, I could accidentally blurt it out in the form of one of my answers for an unrelated question where maybe there is a little overlap where I just accidentally say it, but that would be considered extremely inappropriate and, you know, borderline, you fill in the blank. So oftentimes, because I come in there with high moral ethics, I don't go there at all because the judge already said this is not coming in as evidence. So there's not even an opportunity to say something in front of a jury. So that's usually how it goes down.
What is, you said that they go back 50 years, and we were talking off air, and I was surprised to know that you know, some of the sheriffs, one in particular, I'm going to forget his name, Baccara, was sent to prison, but was a member going all the way back to the 1970s. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, the two deputies that are in prison are not just some regular deputies. We're talking about Lee Baca, who was the head sheriff. He's in prison. And then his second in command, Paul Tanaka, he's also in prison. They both got sentenced to 5 years, basically for doing some gang stuff. But some of the very early gangs that we know that are documented go back to the sheriff deputies called the Hats would be considered one. They formed in 1970. Also, the Little Devils, they also formed around 1970, 71. But I think the most notorious Los Angeles sheriff's deputy gang would be the Vikings. The Vikings became real known. I would say they formed around 1988, and they started getting known around 1990. Between, I'd say from 90 to 95, they were just wreaking havoc on the communities, which would have been in the Century Division of Los Angeles, which is a community that's far, far south, one of the most southern neighborhoods in Los Angeles. And they were just in there, you know, raiding houses. They would raid houses, but then destroy all the furniture and the put bats through TVs, which had nothing to do with the search warrant. And Paul Tanaka, who's currently in prison, when he was a young deputy, he was a member of that gang.
These gangs, when I first heard of them, and this was maybe about 98, 99, so I would assume a lot of this information was because of your work and research, we started to be able to have a name put to this. The explanation that I got, and this is from law enforcement folks, was that these were social clubs and that every profession has a social club and, you know, these aren't real gangs and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. What have been the activities that would, in your mind, put them in the classification of a gang? And what are some of the activities? I know you mentioned a couple in terms of the raids, but to me, this seemed pretty insidious, you know, to have these type of outfits, especially since they're on the taxpayers' dime.
Yeah, you would think that deputies and law enforcement would be put at a higher standard where this type of activity would be completely unacceptable. But unfortunately, I've heard from other officers that it creates good morale. There's a good camaraderie between deputy to deputy when they have these quote unquote organizations. But you know, I'm not a big fan of the word gang because in California, they've taken this term and they criminalized it through what we call the STEP Act. They wrote the STEP Act in 1988, which basically said now that a gang is illegal. But since we have this definition, law enforcement, some of law enforcement is doing the exact same thing. And what's interesting, during the LAPD scandal, which was back in 98, 99, 2000, a judge actually said that this was the LAPD, by the way, a judge actually said that the LAPD officers were acting so reckless that you could actually prosecute them under RICO statutes, which are the federal laws against organized corrupt organizations.
Was this a Rampart scandal or was this another scandal?
Yeah, exactly, the Rampart scandal, because there was about maybe five or six officers that got tried, and some of the judges were just completely, you know, shocked and amazed. And in the late 90s, there may have been some judges that were unaware of it. But yeah, they're doing the same things that quote unquote your typical gang members doing on the streets. I think some of the worst things that they're doing is shooting unarmed people. They also planted guns on unarmed people. They've also paralyzed unarmed people and lied about it in court. And I think the biggest offense that a lot of these police gang members do is they come into court and they perjure themselves like it's nothing, like it's, you know, they'll come in there and make up a story like it's no big deal. And they get away with it because there's no one there to counter it unless a defense attorney hires someone such as myself to say, no, this is untrue. And what's really disappointing is that I often get criticized by the courts for challenging police lies because, oh, but why would these people in uniforms lie? because I've been testifying in court for almost 20 years, but it's, you know, finally the LA Times, the ACLU, Loyola Law School, they've all been documenting this, and I feel I've been vindicated.
When you've testified, Alex, and we're talking with Alex Alonzo, if you're just tuning in, we're talking about the gangs that exist within police departments here in California in particular. When I've testified in the past, what they've gone is they've gone through my social media and they pulled up stuff. And, you know, I remember one case in particular. It was in Baltimore, and they said, you see law enforcement as a bunch of dip, you know, and there was an expletive next to it. And they, you know, and they made me read this in court, and then they went back to, like, a MySpace page. It was, like, crazy. And, you know, and so there was a context to it, and it wouldn't allow that in. So the work that you do, do they bring that up and then go, well, this is Alex Alonzo, and look who he was talking to, or look what he said in the past, or look what he said on these radio shows? And I'm asking this question because part of the criminal, part of the concern that we've had with police officers is that they have posted up reckless and oftentimes racist things on social media themselves. They've been caught on tape doing some very egregious things that, in my opinion, would actually taint a case. And those things aren't often allowed into court, going back to your point about how we get killed in the court.
Yeah, well, these prosecutors, specifically in Los Angeles County, I would even say in the five counties in Southern California, Orange County, Ventura, Riverside, and Orange County, they do some of the most egregious things in court. I'm gonna give you three quick things that that happened to me that I think are quite funny. And usually when they do this, this means that their case is weak and they really don't have much to say about you as an expert. So we'll attack you in another way. I'll give you three quick examples. One time I had a district attorney subpoena my transcripts from the University of Southern California and try to use those against me in a negative way. And it actually backfired on them. That was pretty unusual to have a prosecutor actually get your grades. And it's actually low. It's borderline illegal for the university. I've given that up because they did it under the university thought that they were subpoenaing my transcripts because I was under investigation or I was a suspect. But it Wow. turned out that when they found out that I was the expert witness, they were disappointed also because, you know, they get a request from the Los Angeles DA's office. They think that, oh, man, Alex Alonzo must be involved in a criminal a case, but it wasn't. That's the first one. The second one, I had a picture of me and Nipsey Hussle posted on an Instagram page that they brought into court. And because wow. I was throwing up the W, they made a big deal about that. Like, I was being gang affiliated because I was throwing up the West Coast.
Right.
And I thought that was ridiculous. I was like, wow, you know, they're bringing in Nipsey Hussle photos. And then you mentioned the point about racism. And one of the things that's extremely racist, and this is coming more so from the black community, and it's unfortunate because it doesn't represent all Latinos, but a lot of these police gang members are from the Latino community, unfortunately. They're Mexican Americans. And the gang that you mentioned early on, the Executioners, guess how many black deputies are a member of Executioners? Zero. Why? Because they don't allow black deputies to be a member. Not that I want black deputies to be a member, but it shows us the systematic racism within the department to where blacks, even black deputies, are not allowed into this secret organization. But they do allow Mexican Americans and, of course, white deputies and Asian American deputies. So there's this sort of white supremacist framework where some people of color are allowed in, but the black ones are not allowed in, which really no one is talking about when it comes to the mainstream media.
You mentioned about the Executioners and the makeup. When we first heard about these police gangs, the Vikings in particular, we were told that they were white supremacist gangs, that they had white nationalistic agendas. Can you talk about that and how it's morphed? Because over the years, we've heard about the Bandidos, we're hearing about the Executioners and some of these others, where they're not necessarily all white, but definitely have an anti-black, you know, spin, yeah, at the very least.
Well, all of these police gangs were started by either white officers or white deputies. So regardless of who is the membership, who is involved in it, they're like little Americas. They're little United States within different departments of the Los Angeles County Sheriff's and for a lesser degree within the LAPD. Now, although a lot of Browns, a lot of Mexican Americans, a lot of Asians have participated in it, it doesn't take away the white supremacist framework of which these officer gangs operate in. And then the fact that they shun having black members in it is an indication to that. And then secondly, some of the symbology, the executioners actually have a tattoo where they use a Nazi helmet as representative of the executioners. So there's all this racist symbology, and then of course the shunning of black deputies that lets you know that this is straight operating within a white supremacist framework.
Why haven't we heard more black officers speak out to this? Now, we know in the case of the executioners, you have one officer, one deputy, Art Gonzalez, I believe is his name, who's actually on court now speaking out about this and talking about how his life has been put in danger, and he was actually testifying about a friend who was actually nearly beaten to death by the deputies. And the way that he described it was pretty much like that gang runs that department, yet they are contracted by the city of Compton to go around and patrol for the next, 4 to 5 years. And so I'm just trying to figure out and understand how they're able to operate, how an officer can have racist insignia tattooed on their body, and that doesn't, one, be seen as a tainting of the case, doesn't indicate bias, and why they're even allowed to just operate when that is such an open type of indication that we have a problem there.
Well, historically, believe it or not, black officers and black deputies probably do their job better than any other racial or ethnic group within the department, specifically here in Los Angeles. Most black deputies wouldn't even want to be a part of something like this because of just the whole system, the subsystem within the system. It's already difficult enough being a black cop or a black deputy within the department. Another thing is black deputies and black officers are scrutinized far more than Mexican Americans and other racial minorities. So they come into the department realizing, I can't mess up. I got to walk really, on the straight and narrow, or before you know it, I'm going to get indicted. So they come in with a different attitude, a different mindset. And here's a real interesting story when it comes to black officers. The LAPD, at least at the time, had 18 different divisions in the early 80s up into the 90s, 18 divisions. Now it's 21. But when an LAPD officer first came into the department, they wanted to work at this one department called Wilshire Division. Wilshire Division had a lot of black officers, but this division had a nickname within the LAPD, and it was called Nigger Division. So it was widely known. Yes, it was widely known. And one of your famous officers was commonly called it Nigger Division, Mark Furman. Mark Furman, a known white supremacist, a known racist, would call, and I'm not sure if he's the first one or if he just joined in with the other white officers, but they called Wilshire Division Nigger Division because that's where all the black cops wanted to go because there was, all their other black colleagues. So yeah, there's this like racist system within the department that black officers often talk about, but your question was, why don't we hear them talking about it more often? It's just because, just like what's happening with Art right now, the deputy you mentioned, Art, they're calling Art a snitch. Can you believe this? That Art is being called a snitch because he's the deputy that's exposing what's going on with the executioners. And a lot of these black officers, they wanna just do their job, they wanna go home, they want to raise their families. They don't want to get labeled as a snitch. And again, back to the reform. We got to have this police reform where an officer should be able to speak out against illegalities without being labeled a snitch and being scared to say, hey, there's some criminal activity going on.
How life-threatening is it if any of these officers speak out? In the case of Compton, you saw that I mentioned that, you know, that they nearly beat one of their deputies to death and then told him not to say anything, lie about his injuries. He told Art Gonzalez, who then spoke, and then Art was threatened and is being threatened right now. You know, it seems like a common sense type of thing in terms of, like, of course they're going to be threatened, but I'm trying to just get the details of how that gets carried out. Do we have examples where we've seen this other than what we now know here in this case? But, I mean, we're talking about an organization that's been around for 50 years. I can only imagine that there have been enforcement all along. In the case of the Compton one, they were talking about they wanted one of these officers to see the enforcers. So they had an enforcer within that department that meted out discipline to other officers in a way that would be more, you know, gang related than it was, you know, quote unquote professional, if I could use those words to make the point.
Well, I would say it's extremely dangerous to the deputy who's the whistleblower, because at the end of the day, you can get killed. And that's not an exaggeration. There was a deputy earlier this year that was arrested for shooting another deputy. So we know that there are deputies that are willing to take it that far. And also, they know that they could probably get away with it. You know, they know that they could, the department will probably, especially under Lee Baca, because there's so many things we don't know that's occurred. Under Lee Baca, he probably swept everything under the rug and covered everything up. Because, look, he's sitting in prison right now for trying to cover up an inmate that was trying to expose abuses that's going on in the L.A. County Jail. So I think it's extremely dangerous.
Lee Baca was an elected official. How difficult is it to have somebody who's elected into position to be exposed or removed or to be held accountable? Especially since you said he was actually a member of the Vikings going all the way back to the 70s.
Well, I said Paul Tanaka was a member.
Paul Tanaka, sorry. Yeah, okay.
I'm not 100% sure if Lee Baca ever participated. But, yeah, he's an elected official, and he was picked by the people. And, you know, that one kind of hit me hard because I actually knew Lee Baca personally. I spoke to Lee Baca on several occasions, and he was elected to be this reform deputy. He's going to reform the department. This was in the wake of Sherman Block, because all these gangs that we're talking about pretty much came to fame under Sherman Block. So when Lee Baca came in, we were supposed to see reform, and we thought we were seeing reform, but behind the scenes, there was no reform going on. Lee Baca just continued the tradition of Sherman Block, and basically nothing really changed.
Have you, Alex, have you been to Sacramento? Have there been hearings about any of this, past or present, or do you anticipate something coming down the pipe now that this has gotten a little exposure? Again, I started off by saying the type of fanfare we've seen with elected officials around the existence of Antifa in the wake of George Floyd protests. So we've seen folks say, let's craft legislation. Let's come up with new penalties. Let's have a task force. Let's, you know, there's all this movement to try and make sure that people who protest are not breaking windows and are not associated with, you know, the quote unquote Antifa element. Here we have elected officials like the mayor in Compton speaking out and saying there's a gang that is, you know, abusing our citizenry. Here in Oakland, we had, you know, a clique of officers that were accused of human trafficking and rape and the whole nine. One officer killed himself in the aftermath of all that. We didn't see any hearings. We haven't seen no big, like let us, you know, smash down and blow the whistle on all this from Sacramento. We didn't even see it in Oakland too much. And I'll top this off by saying it was just last week we saw the bill SBE, I think 731, which would have stripped an individual who was a police officer from having a license or whatever credential you need to become a police officer. That bill never even made it to the floor. That meant that the majority in Sacramento said, we're not even going to touch this thing. And that would seem like an open and shut case if it, for any reason, just to get rid of a gang like the executioners. So your experience with the Sacramento legislatures, you know, have they talked to you off camera, on camera? Are you going to be hearings about this?
Well, I haven't spoke to Gavin Newsom at all, but in the past, I've been to Sacramento many times. And in my experiences, I feel like it's a waste of my time, because what happens when the last time I've been up there was under Governor Schwarzenegger. And what happens is they bring academic experts such as myself, but they also still rely on law enforcement experts. So it ends up becoming a battle of ideas where two groups are on opposite sides, and you know where the police are standing. So I don't really see that we get much done in that area, but maybe in this post-George Floyd era, things will start to change. I will say that California, as liberal as people may think it is not that liberal. When you see a bill like SB 731 not go through, in addition to about three or four other bills that didn't go through, we voted on the death penalty, and the citizens of California upheld the death penalty. So we actually have this like real low-key, undercover, very conservative electorate that doesn't want to see these things go through, that don't want to see these changes. But if Gavin Newsom calls me up, I'll take the call. But I will say that I hope you guys are sincere about making some serious changes, because it's not just these police gangs, but it's all the other things associated with policing street gangs that's the problem. One of them I would say is the Cal Gangs database. They have a database on every black and brown person that they believe is a gang member. And this database is used in a very abusive way. And we gotta get rid of this database. This database is racist. It is inaccurate. It's only designed to disenfranchise and marginalize more black and brown people. So if I do go to Sacramento and Gavin Newsom does call me up, we're gonna have this whole conversation, from police gangs to the gang database, and also the gang units that the LAPD have and the sheriffs have.
How is the gang database used that it becomes abusive?
Well, the gang database, there's so many things. For example, after 5 years, if you're entered into the database, you're supposed to get purged from it completely. And we're finding out they're not purging people after 5 years. If you have 5 years of no contact, which is a lot. That's thousands of people, hundreds of people not getting purged off the database. Also, there's a very short standard of getting put into the database. In fact, a former singer who sang on Coolio's Gangsta Paradise song back in 1995, he's in his 50s. He just got entered into the gang database here in LA. This dude ain't never gangbanged a day in his life. He ain't never been a member of a gang. He has no gang tattoos, but he just got entered in it because they send you a letter when you get entered it. So those two things right off the bat have to be corrected. But, you know, we're getting a lot of pushback from the people who run the gang database saying that, oh, we need it, it's so important. But no, if they're going to have it, we got to have standards. We got to have rules. If they're going to purge people, we got to make sure they're getting purged out of it. And right now, as it stands right now, they can pretty much do whatever they want with the database.
How big in that database are white nationalists, white militias, neo-Nazi types? Are they into that database? You talked about the conservatism in California. And, you know, as soon as we leave the Bay and go up to Sacramento, you have a lot of white nationalists. You have those type of, you know, that type of presence. Are they seen in the same light?
Well, here's another problem. Here's a third problem I mentioned with the database. There's no transparency. So I can't even tell you how many white nationalist groups are in there or how many Nazi groups are in there, because the only people that are allowed to access it are prosecutors and police officers. So not even a defense attorney has access to go look in there to see what they have on his own client. So until they provide us some transparency, we have no clue. It's probably just filled. My guess is, and I'm just speculating, it's just filled up with a whole bunch of black and brown people right now.
Wow. Do you know if you're on there? Just for the work that you do?
I actually thought about that a while ago, and I was just saying to myself, you know what? They probably got my name up in there. But, you know, if they got my name up in there, it would be a huge thing. If they're smart, they probably like, nah, keep his name out of it. But I wouldn't be shocked if my name is in that database, because I do a lot of the criteria that will get you in that database. I do a lot of that stuff. You know, I hang out in gang neighborhoods. I talk to gang members. I may have been photographed with other gang members, like Nipsey Hussle. So who knows? I'm probably up in there.
And for people who don't know, you've interviewed many of these folks, which is how you have established your reputation, you know, both as a researcher and as somebody who does interviews. And your interviews aren't like the, you know, the type where it's sensationalized, like, why did you shoot him? What was it like? But it's really more of, like, if you want rich history, that's where we go to. You really give the breakdown on that.
Yeah, my interviews are designed for the person, the interviewee, to tell their story. And if they want to talk about something they did in the past, that's fine. But I'm not asking about drugs, guns. I'm more interested in how did you get involved in the culture? Why did you get involved in the culture? And I even ask about family dynamics. What was going on at home? Mom or dad or lack of dad or foster? A lot of these people are foster kids, you know? Our foster system is feeding Los Angeles gang culture. So I ask those type of questions and allow them and give them the opportunity to tell their story.
Based upon the research you've done, Alex, why do you think there have been these gangs that have formed within the Southern Cali police departments? And also, is it just limited to Southern Cali? Do we have, you know, just like in the Bay, we don't quote unquote have gangs, we have cliques and families and other things, so we don't have the Crips blood dynamic that you have in LA. Do we see that sort of transference up to the police departments here in a place like Vallejo, for example, where they were just talking about how the officers, when they shoot somebody, turn their badges a certain way? So that indicates, you know, some sort of connectivity. So how widespread are the gangs in the police departments?
Well, because I spend so much of my time just trying to keep up what's going on in Los Angeles, you know, Los Angeles County is a county of 88 cities. There's 10 million people here. And it doesn't allow me the opportunity to investigate this problem outside of this county. So I don't know how many of these type of gangs exist, but I will say that whenever anything's going on in Los Angeles as it relates to gangs, they're sharing this culture, the cops, with other cops from other cities, because they do an annual conference. It's called the California Gang Investigators Association. I got invited to the conference one time to speak on some research, but because I'm not a cop, they didn't allow me in the rooms. So what's going on in those rooms is a lot of socializing. And these are cops that are flying in from Florida, Texas, Oklahoma. They want to learn, what does the LA cop know? So I wouldn't be surprised if they're spreading that culture to these other cops in these other departments. But to answer your first question of why do we have these guys that are interested in this gang culture from a law enforcement background in the first place, I would just say that, for example, it seems like every rapper wants to be a professional athlete, and every athlete wants to be a rapper. And that's, I'm generalizing, of course. And when these police, to a certain degree, they look up to some of these gang members. They look up to some of these tough guys. And even though we on the streets grow up respecting that tough guy and that fighter and the dude that was, you know, the one you didn't mess with, the cops actually low-key respect that guy too, but they won't admit it. So what they do is they create their own gangs, because they're mirroring what they see on the streets. They're mirroring that the camaraderie they see on the streets, and they're saying, hey, we should do that too. So, and it's kind of bizarre, because they're there to police the gangs, but to a certain degree, they're admiring those gangs.
How much of this, well, two questions. One, how much presence or influence does quote-unquote organized gangs, mafia, for example, those type of cartels, how much of that influence gets, you know, adapted by these police departments? Or do they even come on the radar when they're doing their work? You know, and let me give you an example. I remember talking with some of these police that do all this investigation around rappers. right? So they take in all this information. And when I've had conversations, I'm like, okay, so this is cool. You want to talk to all the rappers in their street connects, but do you talk to the executives and do you see their organized crime connects? Because that is pretty clear. Records don't get on the radio without going through them. You know, certain type of practices in the industry is all directly connected with organized crime, and that's been well documented. So I was always curious if they ever sing and dance in that area. And they were pretty emphatic, like, no, that's not really where the problem is. We go here. So they're more interested in Nipsey Hussle and his gang affiliations before they're interested in a record executive, you know, who has these organized crime affiliations. Is that the same with the police down there?
I would have to say it's very similar, because most deputies and most police officers or police gangs, they have a very limited framework when it comes to thinking. It's very hard for them to see the bigger picture. And they're just tasked to do one thing. The old LAPD saying is, we intimidate those that intimidate others. So that's what their job is, to go out there, intimidate those that intimidate others. And when you have that type of a framework and that thinking, you're not looking at the bigger picture. You're not looking at the kid that's slanging rocks in the corner and saying to yourself, I wonder the cartel that these rocks are connected to. That the 15-year-old kid is selling, because those rocks are connected to a cartel in Mexico somewhere. But that thinking is just beyond them. And to a certain degree, it's beyond their job as well. Their job is very limited in scope. They're just there to arrest and investigate as many black and brown bodies as possible.
As we close out, Alex Alonzo, let me ask you this. From your standpoint, what should our listeners be doing at this point in time? It seems like almost an impossible situation. The cops who are supposed to protect them are now members of gangs. There's definitely an anti-black sentiment. We have elected officials, you know, that are steadfastly refusing the demands of the public. So they're dragging their feet on defunding. They drag their feet on punishing. What do we do at this point in time?
Well, we definitely got to make phone calls to Sacramento and get this on Gavin Newsom's radar, because that's where the leadership should come from. But also at the same time, what the problem that I had during the 90s and early 2000s was too many people doubted these stories. Too many people challenged the citizens' stories. And we got to start listening to the people. We got to start believing their narrative and putting their narrative into our stories rather than dispelling them. If you go through the LA Times articles, and I've went through just about every LA Times article from 1980 to the present, it took them like 20 years to talk about this.
Wow.
You know? And this is something that should have been on the radar years ago. And it's documented in the courts. Another thing we need to do, we gotta pay attention to what's going on in the courts. These trials that happen are open court. Anybody can go in there and listen. So if you would have went into court back in 1992, 1993, you would have seen these arguments between defense attorneys and prosecutors about police gangs and how much of this evidence is going to come into court. So we need to really be more cognizant of what's going on in the courtroom process. And we got to also emphasize on reform, not just from the police, but we got to have reform in the courts. The way that these trials take place, the way that these hearings occur, the decisions that these judges make, because they're killing us in the court far more than they're killing us in the street.
Have the ACLU, National Lawyers Guild, National Bar Association, which is the Black Lawyers think tank, NAACP, have they been in conversation with you to see about ways in which they can monitor the courts and really take into account a lot of this information that might not make it on the evening news?
Well, I've had a lot of conversations with the ACLU and also the Loyola Law School on various topics, including the Cal Gangs database and also gang injunctions, which was a fight that I had been in for years. And we finally got them to stop using gang injunctions. And real quickly, just gang injunctions are like they're like court orders or restraining orders against gangs. As of 2018, the city of LA doesn't use them anymore. But we haven't really got to the conversations now about what's going on in the courts. And I'm hoping that the attorneys at Loyola Law School and some of the attorneys at the ACLU will start to evolve and say, all right, this is where our next fight is going to take place.
My last question, do we see these the eradication of these gangs within the police department?
No, you're not going to see the eradication of these gangs. They are too entrenched. It's like saying, are we going to get rid of the Crips and Bloods in L.A.? It's not going to happen overnight. They're too entrenched. They already are part of a subculture. They have tattoos. They socialize. They're not just going to stop, you know. And if they can manage to lessen the power of, let's say, the executioners, guess what? A new one will form, you know. It's just now becoming a normalized part of Los Angeles policing culture, and it most likely will not end until we start putting these officers in prison. The indictment that the feds had in back in 2015 or 16 led 18 deputies to prison. But 18 deputies out of what, 10,000 is really like a drop in the bucket. And actually, another thing that could happen is the feds need to get involved. The federal government needs to get involved and start investigating, because that's when we start seeing police officers and deputies go to prison. Because guess what? Jackie Lacey, who's the DA of Los Angeles, she's not going to do anything about this. So the only way that some of these deputies are really going to get punished, penalized, if it comes from the federal government.
Real talk. Alex Alonzo, we thank you for joining us this afternoon. If people want to follow your work, get a hold of you, your writings, your videos, how can they do that?
They could just hit me up on streetgangs.com, and they can find me at AlexAlonzo101 on all social media platforms.
And Alonzo's with an S.
Correct. Alonzo's with an S, definitely. Thanks for pointing that out.
Yeah, there you go. Because it pulls up an actor when you go the other way, Al Alonzo or something crazy like that. So.
Oh, Laz Alonzo.
Yeah, something like that. So, yeah.
That's my brother. That's actually my brother from the Caribbean. We're probably actually related because we're both from the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. He's from Cuba. My family's from Puerto Rico. But, yeah, I know who Laz Alonzo is. Yeah.
There you go.